This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, there are fewer Republicans than there are Democrats, but the GOP controls the federal government and most of the states. We'll ask political analyst Paul Street why that happens. And Uganda has once again invaded the Democratic Republic of Congo, the site of the worst genocide since World War II. But first, Jill Stein, the Green Party's 2016 presidential candidate, has been targeted for investigation by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The committee's suggesting sinister motives for Stein's attendance at a dinner hosted by the popular Russian news site RT. Democrats, corporate media, and U.S. spy agencies have attempted to demonize RT for its practice of interviewing independent U.S. political parties and human rights advocates. Ajamu Baraka was Jill Stein's running mate on the Green Party ticket. We asked Baraka if the Greens had anticipated getting caught up in the anti-Russian hysteria.
Well, you know, Glenn, we did see that possibility quite some time ago, where it became quite clear that the investigation was striking out in various directions because the core of it was so weak. And we knew that on the Senate committee, there were a number of Democrats, of course, who were driving this so-called investigation, who wanted to use the investigation to address all of their political objectives. And one, I think, very important political objective was to undermine and smear any third-party attempts that could impact their ability to mobilize the vote in 2018 and in 2020. So the smear of the allegation that somehow Jill Stein and by extension the Stein-Baraka campaign were in some way colluding with the Russians is a very effective weapon, one that we've seen deployed during the first McCarthy era witch hunts back in the 1950s, where you basically end up on the defensive just as a consequence of the allegation. So we weren't surprised. We knew a few weeks ago, before it became public, that there was going to be that very strong possibility. And so when it became public, Jill was then sort of freed up to begin to address the allegations directly.
Yes, the CIA report that alleges Russian meddling in the U.S. political system focuses on RT, the news agency, and although it produces no smoking gun, but what it basically says is that RT is engaged in a campaign against the U.S. political system by, for example, covering Black Lives Matter and giving coverage to third-party candidates like you and Jill Stein.
Exactly. Most of the allegations of supposed collusion was based on a political assessment that suggested that if the campaign was taking certain political positions that seemed to be closely connected to positions that were articulated by various commentators who appear on the RT network, then that was supposed to be an example of the kind of ideological collusion that was taking place between the campaign and RT. But many people around the world see RT as a respectable outlet in the same vein as a BBC and any other of those media outlets that have a connection to public resources of their particular state. And while we know that RT has a variety of voices that appear on that show, on that channel, we know that there are a number of individuals who have credibility and respect from the progressive and radical community that also end up on that channel. And therefore, the notion that it is just some type of mouthpiece for the Russian state, I think it's not only silly, but it's dangerous. But it's something that's been used by the corporate sector and the state. Because, Glenn, the issue is not even RT. And I've been engaged in a conversation with a number of so-called leftists in the U.S. on this very issue. The issue is not RT. It is using RT as an entry point to reduce the range of information and analysis that's available to not only the public in the U.S., but to the global public. And we're seeing this collusion between the state and the corporate sector, a collusion that I think is more threatening than anything that the Senate investigation may be coming up with, in which they have decided that they're going to attempt to bury radical information, radical analysis, by burying the outlet that those analysis and information appears on. And we've seen the result of that, that with Google deciding that they're going to change their algorithms to make it more difficult to access radical outlets, the same thing with Twitter accounts to determine which ones are acceptable to the public and which ones are not. We see a very troubling move toward a narrowing of information, a process that is really revealing the corporate ideological totalitarianism that has been strengthened as a consequence of this whole Russiagate issue and this new McCarthyism that is rapidly becoming normalized in this country, driven not by the political right necessarily, but driven by the other part of the political right that we don't always identify as the political right, and that is these neoliberal corporatist Democrats. This is the political right that I'm more concerned with, and this is the political right that sees the third-party efforts of the Green Party as a threat to its continued grip on the politics of the working class in this country and their neoliberal standing.
Yes, we see much of the suppression of dissent coming from the Democratic Party, which is the home of much of that which calls itself the left in the United States.
Exactly, and it's a testament, or it reveals the rightist character of politics in this country, especially when you see that even so-called progressive and radical elements allow themselves to be completely manipulated by this sector of the bourgeoisie. The normalization of the argument that the way you counter the more dramatic and obvious lunatic right reflected in those rightist forces that showed up in Charlottesville is to then embrace and collaborate with the neoliberal right, and that is then projected as a progressive position. It just reveals the extent to which politics in the U.S. is, in fact, an impoverished politics, and it reflects the absolute necessity, then, for those of us who are committed to building independent politics to basically disengage ourselves from this game, disengage and separate ourselves from the politics of the lesser of two evilism. It means building an alternative politics with alternative structures, with the objective of building a popular power and understanding that that process is a projected process that cannot be reduced just to the electoral cycles. And it means also, too, that while we may engage in the electoral arena, we understand completely that we're not going to vote ourselves to liberation, that any participation in the electoral arena is mainly a strategic or tactical kind of question, that we've got to be building these structures of dual power. And the bourgeoisie understands that. That's why they're trying to preempt that kind of movement toward really building viable independent politics. And that's why it's really unfortunate that leftist forces in the U.S. are so short-sighted that they don't understand the long-term objectives and have allowed themselves to be incorporated into the politics of the Democratic Party and are getting themselves placed where they are going to be again in 2018, and especially in 2020, involved once again in the lesser of two evilism, where basically we are forced to make a decision between those two representatives of the duopoly.
Yes, we're in need of a reconstruction of the left here in the United States, and to make it clear that nothing is genuinely left that is not also anti-imperialist.
Exactly, and that anti-imperialist thrust is something that I think would differentiate the politics on the so-called left as it relates to whatever electoral representative that one might be considering, that basically what defines one as a authentic left element is one in which you are in solidarity with the people of the world. That not only are you a concern about oppression in the U.S., you are concerned about the global structures of oppression. And you recognize then that one of the major instruments being used to evoke and to impose suffering on the peoples of the world is, in fact, the U.S. state. And it is, in fact, the use of the U.S. state's military and intelligence agencies to undermine democracy, to impose war and repression on peoples around the world. So basically, if you're not an anti-imperialist, if you're not forthrightly opposing the U.S. state and militarism and war and imperialism, then basically you cannot, in my mind, twist up your mouth and call yourself a revolutionary or call yourself a so-called radical. You are, in fact, nothing but a class collaborator. And so that's where we are today. And that's why it's important for us to draw these lines of demarcation. It's important for people who really believe in democratic rights to be opposed to the move being made by the Senate committee to investigate the Stein-Baraka campaign, to use Russiagate to narrow the base of political discourse and information in this country. It's time for those forces to reveal themselves and for us to be able to organize ourselves to be able to resist the intensification of the repression that we know is coming in 2018 and beyond, because the state has no other options right now than to use force and repression because of its continuing decline in power and its legitimation crisis in this country. So the only thing they have now is continued and more intense repression. And the focus on the Stein-Baraka campaign is just one expression of their desperation.
And when we speak of the infrastructure of imperialism, the most dramatic expression of that is the vast network of U.S. bases, numbering, depending upon how you count them, as many as 1,000 across the world. There's going to be an important conference in Baltimore this month coming up, and you'll be part of it.
Exactly. Part of what we have to do as authentic radicals who stand in solidarity with the people of the world, who recognize that one cannot be concerned with domestic repression, police violence in the U.S., and not be in opposition to the violence being imposed on the peoples of the world, is that we have to build a viable, strong, effective anti-war, pro-peace movement that has an anti-imperialist character also. Part of what we are doing to, in fact, do that, we have put together the Black Alliance for Peace, along with a number of other organizations, have put together a coalition in which the focus right now for that this coalition is on this vast array of U.S. bases around the world. This notion that the U.S. cannot or should not be is not seen as an empire is absolutely ridiculous. When you look at the fact that here is a state that has bases, depending on how you define a base, between 800 and 1,000 around the world. And we say that if you're concerned about the global community, if you're concerned about repression, if you're concerned about human rights, then you have to join us to make it a demand that the U.S. close those bases, bring those troops back to the U.S., cease and desist from its subversion in these various countries, use that $150 billion that are used now to support those bases, to address the material needs of the people in the U.S. So we are coming together in January 12th, to, in fact, launch this No U.S. Foreign Bases campaign, where we are calling for the closure of these bases. The Black Alliance for Peace, we are going to focus even more intensely, though, on U.S. foreign bases in Africa. So we are going to be there. I'm one of the keynote speakers at that conference representing the Black Alliance for Peace. And we have a number of our activists who will be there in Baltimore. And we are using this campaign to, as the entry point, to raise the issue of the U.S. empire, to make the connection between what is happening on the African continent as a consequence of the intervention, the recolonization of Africa by the U.S. using military means, and the continued and intensifying repression by the domestic military that we call the police forces in our Black and brown colonized spaces within the U.S. Those connections have to be made, and we've got to make those connections and build viable structures of resistance to address that objective reality of repression.
Well, how has the organizing been going for the Black Alliance for Peace? We had 8 years of the first Black president who continued all of George Bush's wars and started a number of his own.
With the organizing, we've been in existence for just 7 months, and we are building a viable alliance of individuals and organizations. We have no money. We have no real staff. But we have a fierce determination to build this resistance, and we've been making significant inroads. We are still trying to address our material needs. We have a goal to try to raise resources by the end of this month to support our work with this campaign on U.S. No U.S. foreign bases and to bring our folks together for our first annual meeting of the membership in April. We launched April the 4th of last year to the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's resistance to the Vietnam War, and April would be our one-year anniversary of the Black Alliance for Peace. So we're making progress because there's this vacuum there. There's this demand coming from the people who are looking for real alternatives. And for people who understand that we're not going to be able to build a viable anti-war movement without the full participation and, in fact, leadership coming from the Black community. But we are galvanizing our forces. We are organizing our people to, in fact, take up that historic responsibility to provide that kind of input and that kind of leadership to the global head of the country. Our tagline is that we are a people-centered human rights project against war, repression, and imperialism. We make sure that people understand that we're not just about pro-peace. We're about pro-peace. But we understand that without justice, there could be no peace. And as long as you have imperialism, you cannot have justice. Therefore, we've got to struggle and fight for peace.
That was Green Party 2016 vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka, who's also an editor of Black Agenda Report. Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly denounced the Democrats' attack on Jill Stein.
The Democrats are in a very desperate state of affairs. That ought to be good news, but they will pose great dangers to millions of people before they experience their final death throes. The most visible tool for their attempt at self-preservation is the so-called Russiagate scandal, the investigation of alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. Democrats have always hated the left far more than they hate the right. Under the guise of fighting Russian influence, they are now waging an all-out war against anyone who opposes them from that political direction. Hillary Clinton's defeat in the Electoral College in 2016 had to be explained away and defended, lest rank-and-file Democrats begin asking questions about their party's failures, which culminated in the Day of Reckoning. Russiagate explained the debacle perfectly and had the added advantage of continuing the war by other means against Russia. And that will continue because the Democrats are happy members of the bipartisan imperialist war party. Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate, is the latest victim in the tawdry scam. She has been a convenient scapegoat for Democrats ever since the 2016 election. Hillary Clinton had the simple task of conducting a get-out-the-vote effort in key swing states, an important step on the path to Electoral College victory for Democrats. She raised $1 billion, enough money to do anything she wanted, and she had near universal support from the corporate media. Even many Republicans stood down in the belief that Donald Trump would lose. But Hillary is the one who fumbled what should have been a simple task, and in so doing created panic among the bipartisan ruling elite. Thus far, Russiagate reveals personal connections between Trump and individuals in Russia. We know that his son Donald Trump Jr. is stupid, that former aide Paul Manafort is a crook, and that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn spoke to Russia's ambassador, but on behalf of Israel. The flimsy evidence of collusion is built on repetition of dubious innuendo and the deliberate exclusion of any voices who might provide a counter-narrative. There are indications that some Republicans were willing to shove Trump under the proverbial bus, but the tax bill victory and Zionist clamoring for recognition of Jerusalem may have saved him from impeachment. But there will always be a Green Party to kick around and help the Democrats kill many birds with one stone. First, a Senate committee asked Donald Trump Jr. to produce any communication he had with Jill Stein. Stein immediately made clear that no such communication took place. Now that the investigation and the resolve to get Trump are teetering, Jill Stein has once again become the focus of cynical ire among duplicitous politicians, lackey pundits doing their bidding, and the passive, easily fooled Democratic Party membership. Stein has been asked to provide the Senate Intelligence Committee with any documentation relating to her 2015 trip to the RT anniversary gala held in Moscow. She was seated at a table with Flynn and Vladimir Putin, and that is all. But the image is blood in the water to the sharks. They have used everything from clickbait hustles emanating from a variety of Eastern European countries to an oligarch bailing out Trump's Miss Universe pageant to prove the most sinister motives possible. But the attack is not just on Jill Stein and Green Party vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka. It is an attack on the freedom of speech that Americans claim to revere so much. It is an attack on the ability to publicly oppose United States foreign policy and freely communicate with people and governments all over the world. The damage done by the persecution of Stein will emanate far beyond the Green Party. Already Google, Facebook, and Twitter have publicly acknowledged that they are censoring speech and curtailing access to certain sites. The ruse has succeeded, and Democrats have joined Republicans in silencing anyone who opposes their joint efforts at promoting U.S. hegemony around the world. Let us be clear, Russia has decisively moved away from trying to appease the United States. Along with their allies, the Russians defeated the regime change attempt in Syria and have strengthened their relationship with China. The two countries are working together to protect themselves and thwart the U.S. whenever possible. Democrats and Republicans may convince the rubes that Russia interfered in the election when they actually have other causes for concern. But if Americans are afraid to speak out to denounce their government as they've been told they have a right to do, the bad actors have a free hand. That is what they hope to accomplish by making an example of Jill Stein. And that is why she must be defended without hesitation or reservation by anyone who claims to be on the left.
That was Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly. The Republican tax cut has become law, despite being favored by only about one quarter of the U.S. people. In electoral terms, the Republican president and his party are supported by only minorities of voters, but dominate federal and state governments. Historian, author, and activist Paul Street has some thoughts on how such things happen. His latest book is titled, They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy.
No one seems to ever want to talk about the Constitution and the straitjacket that it is and the federal system. That it is on anything remotely close to democracy. There's a number of left writers over the years that have tried to draw attention to the absurdity and the openly anti-democratic, and really, when you go back to the Founding Fathers, the explicitly and consciously and purposefully anti-democratic structure of the American political system. I think particularly Daniel Lazar wrote a really wonderful and important book that listeners ought to get a hold of called Frozen Republic, which is all about the way our constitutional system, I mean, it's just amazing how we bow down and sort of kiss the rear ends of these openly authoritarian, anti-democratic founding fathers, you know, wearing powdered wigs, slave owners and merchant capitalists in the late 18th century. And we still sort of are beholden to this ancient scriptural document called the U.S. Constitution, which explicitly over-empowers rural populations, you know, which are mainly red state districts in this country. Now, there's an absurd over-representation of the non-urban, rural, non-metropolitan population, both in the Electoral College system and in the U.S. Senate. Now, in theory, the House of Representatives is apportioned in accord with population, you know, with majority population, and is therefore consistent with the basic democratic principle of majority rule. But in reality, the way districts are drawn is very explicitly authoritarian and partisan, and it's under the control of Republicans. Because Republicans control state governments, district lines, House of Representatives, district lines are drawn at the state level, and Republicans control more than two-thirds of the state governments in this country, and they draw the lines. They take the census numbers and they craft the geographic outlines of House of Representatives electoral districts in such a way as to minimize any possible opposition in Congress. And sort of that's the system that we have right now that no one ever seems to want to question. It's quite constitutional.
But of course, it's really not the 32% of Trump supporters or the 25% who support the tax plan who are in charge. It's the 1%.
That's absolutely right. And because of the sort of extreme, mindless, partisan polarization that has taken hold of American politics in the last few decades, celebrating this as some kind of victory for their side, when in fact many of the people, even within Trump's own constituency, are going to get absolutely nothing from a so-called tax reform that more than 80% of the benefits of which go to the top 1%. I mean, the bill drastically slashes the corporate tax rate in ways that are going to benefit very few of us. It encourages corporations to invest in automation without offering any assistance to displaced workers, and that's going to hurt many, even among Trump's most passionate red state supporters. I mean, how many of us are going to benefit from the elimination of the estate tax, the death tax, so-called, for the nation's richest families? What percentage of Trump voters are going to benefit from that? There's an increase in the national debt that is estimated as high as $1.5 to $2 trillion over the next decade. And what is that all about? Well, a lot of the liberal commentators try to refer to that as some sort of contradiction. You know, aren't these guys fiscal conservatives? Don't they understand that they're blowing up the deficit? But of course, it's no contradiction and it's no paradox at all. This is what the United States has done to much of the third world over many years. You blow up debt, you blow up deficits, and it's setting the stage for going after and rolling back the nation's three biggest so-called entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, which will be cut back in the name of scaling back so-called entitlement programs in order to reduce the deficit. And I love that term, entitlement, right? It sort of implies something that we kind of dysfunctionally cling to, that we think we deserve, but we don't really deserve, which hides the fact that Social Security, Medicare are forms of deferred wages. They're systems that we've paid into over many years of our working lives. They're going to roll back these programs, in essence, when they do that, in order to reduce the deficit. That'll be the justification given for that. It's basically putting an overall lifetime wage cut on us and reducing our life expectancy and reducing our incomes. We're going to have millions more of Americans eating out of dog and cat food cans and not going in for checkups that they need. And we'll see an escalation of the historic declines that we've seen in American life expectancy, extending now to white, lower middle, and working class people over the last few years. Most of Trump's voters weren't working class, but he had plenty of them. The working class Trump partisans can look forward to that.
So the Republicans are ringing in the new year with celebrations, but Wall Street has been on a bacchanal all year in anticipation of just these kinds of changes.
Well, I mean, how they were able to make the case that they needed a cut of the corporate tax rate, you know, down to 20%. Originally, they wanted 15%, right? When they were already making a record-setting profits, right? When they were already stashing millions and billions of dollars away in their coffers is just one of the great propaganda victories, I suppose, of all time. And of course, they've insisted that this will lead to an expansion of job growth in this country. And every reputable economist that I've seen function as a talking head or as a op-ed columnist and all that says pretty much flat out that they've already had so much money, they already got so many profits stashed away, they didn't need a tax cut in order to do that. In other words, what they're really going to do is just pay out higher dividends to their stockholders who are already filthy rich, and they're going to engage in a lot of buyback of their own stock in order to bid up the price of their shares and raise CEO compensation to, you know, yet more absurd levels in a country where the top 10th of the top 1% has as much wealth as the bottom 90%, you know, where 12% of the population is food insecure, relies on food price, where 36% of Black and Native American children live below, you know, the notoriously inadequate poverty level. So I guess it's, you know, it's all about the Gilded Age. Isn't Gilded enough? And we need to make it yet more concentrated in terms of its wealth and its power.
But the Democrats had already bought decades ago into the Republican business argument that lower tax rates lead to more economic growth. So did President Obama.
Oh, no, that's absolutely right. And they're sort of making a great deal out of being against this measure, which they knew could pass without their votes. I'm not making actually as much a big deal about the bill as one might have thought, but making enough out of it to try and garner advantage in the 2018 midterm elections and the 2020 elections. They know the thing polls very, very badly. They know it's unpopular, and they're looking forward to rallying their party back to majority status, they hope, in the House and the Senate, by sort of posing as being against a bill that's really not all that different from the kind of things that they supported in the past.
Well, of course, the great question is, with majorities of Americans outraged, alarmed, and afraid at the turn of events, why don't we see hordes, legions of people in the streets?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I was just in Chicago, and I went in there to give a talk, and I made a point of walking up by the Trump Tower, you know, this great gleaming totalitarian structure in the North Loop, and sort of wondering where the people were. Where were the protesters? Just a year ago, there were raucous protests outside that structure just about every day, it seemed like. And, you know, Trump had just utterly defied the public opinion, as he loves to do. I think he enjoys it. It's fun. It's all part of being a sort of a dear leader, Kim Jong-un, Rodrigo Duterte type of autocrat. He loves to defy public opinion. And his FCC had just the other day, when I was in town, defied public opinion by rolling back net neutrality on behalf of Comcast and Verizon and AT&T and all of that. And it wasn't a single solitary soul protesting outside Trump Tower. Everybody knew that the tax cut was coming. CNN was talking about it. It was clear as day. I think part of it is the Christmas season now. Everybody was shopping, but there's incredibly little protest. There's incredibly little activity in the streets over this just phenomenally outrageous bill up at distributing wealth upwards. And you know why that is? Well, I mean, I think part of it is this kind of belief that we get our say in elections. We go into a voting booth once every 2 minutes, every 2 or 4 years, and that's what we supposedly get our say. And, well, we lost. You know, we got our say and we lost. Never mind the fact that Hillary Clinton was a corporate neoliberal 1% candidate in her own right. Never mind the skewing of the electoral system in the first place that goes back many decades, centuries even, in this country. We had our say and we lost. So we really don't need to protest because there's going to be elections again in 2018. We'll get to go in to a voting booth for 2 minutes in less than a couple years from now, and then again in less than 4 years from now, and make choices, you know, in competitive elections between candidates from the two dominant parties. So we don't really have to do anything right now. I mean, a lot of the protest that you saw last year wasn't about policy. It wasn't about what government was actually doing. It was about an election outcome. That's why a lot of people were in the streets, it seems to me. They're so focused on elections, the politics of who's sitting in the White House, the governor's office in Congress, you know, instead of the politics of who's sitting in the streets, you know, to change policy and to shake the country from the bottom up, very focused on electoral politics. I think that's keeping people out of the streets. you know, MSNBC and CNN and Rachel Maddow and all those folks pointing us constantly to special elections, to midterm elections, to quadrennial elections. That's the only politics that matters. Right? That's politics. That's the only politics that matters. I think also, too, that the liberal media, liberal elite, the Democratic liberals elites, have been focusing people very heavily on this kind of magical thinking that will ultimately restore the decent civilized rule of law through impeachment, that Trump is going to be impeached. So we're all just sort of supposed to be staring, mesmerized, and hopefully at the Robert Mueller investigation and sort of hope against hope and dream, you know, magically that this will somehow lead a majority Republican House of Representatives to impeach Donald Trump for collusion with Russia and or obstruction of justice, and that that will be passed on to the Senate and somehow lead magically to a 2/3 vote to remove Donald Trump from office. Again, a majority Republican Senate. The Republicans in both houses are sort of bending over backwards to kiss boss tweets, but for his, you know, brilliant, spectacular tax reform victory, doesn't seem very likely that they're going to do that, but oh well, maybe we'll get a majority in the House of Representatives in 2018, and then they'll vote for impeachment, and on and on and on with these kind of magical dreams that will fix things with election and impeachment proceedings.
Put in that context, Russiagate appears to be not just a diversion from reality, but function as a way to divert people from taking direct action in resistance to the Republican, the Trump agenda.
Oh, I mean, I think that's exactly what it's about. I mean, I think that this is when the Democrats really earn their money from the ruling class. I've sort of maintained for years that Democrats are most dangerous when they're out of power. I mean, they're almost less dangerous in some ways. And this is a complicated question when they're in power, because they're at least exposed as part of the corporate and imperial system when, for example, they hold the White House. When they're out of it, it feeds this narrative that everything that's wrong with the country is that the wrong party, those evil, big, nasty Republicans, are in charge of the White House. And that sort of feeds the sense that everything has to be about turning all social movements into a big get-out-the-vote program, you know, for the Democrats. But when the Democrats are out of office, this is when they really earn their money from Wall Street and corporate America. They get to pose as the left opposition, you know, and they get to do everything they can to get their hooks in the backs of everything that might become a real, genuine grassroots protest and social movement, and instead shut that down and channel it narrowly into these sort of electoral dreams. I think Russiagate, which is something I really underestimated from the beginning of the Trump presidency, how successful the Democrats were going to be able to be, to use that in this kind of way. I mean, I think Russiagate has just been absolutely a masterstroke, a dark, horrible, totalitarian kind of inauthentic opposition masterstroke on the part of the Democrats, A, to keep the country focused on the new Cold War with Russia, which Hillary Clinton was so deeply invested in, B, to distract attention away from the Democrats, from the neoliberal corporate Democrats' dismal responsibility for their own defeat in the 2016 elections, right? Blame it on something outside of the country, outside of themselves. Blame it on an evil Russian intervention in our supposed great democratic process. And also distract the population from their own complicity and their own involvement in the very same corporate state that the Republicans and them are deeply participatory in creating. It's really been quite brilliant. I mean, all these horrible, horrible, completely monstrous things have been going on under Trump. Ecocide, the further destruction of the natural environment, savage nativism, savage racism, savage militarism. I could go down the list of all these horrific things that supposedly liberals and progressives are against on principle, and all of them by the Democrats have sort of been trumped as the reason we're supposed to hate Donald Trump. There's all kinds of reasons to hate Donald Trump. I mean, we just start with this racism, it's savage racism. But all of that gets pushed aside, and the narrative becomes all about Russia, which they want us to think we can impeach him on. And we're dying out here for lack of health care. We're dying out here for reasons of economic inequality. People are dying out across this country because of nativism and racism. I could just go on and on and on. But it's all about Russia. And it distracts the citizenry from the Democrats' own complicity in those problems and their own involvement in why Trump is in the White House in the first place.
Yes, Russiagate has resulted in distraction from the issue of black voter suppression.
Absolutely. You know, the voter ID laws and the purging of the election rolls, the shenanigans with immigrant voting and with black American voting, those things in and of themselves, as in 2000 and as in 2004, but probably more dramatically this time in the upper Midwest, you know, where you had state governments under the control of racist nativist Republicans, and they crafted the voting process in such a way as to guarantee a Republican victory. You could just focus on that stuff alone if you were concerned about the legitimacy of the 2016 election. That stuff alone tilted it to Trump. I think it did in Wisconsin. I think it did in Michigan. I don't know that there's enough of a minority population in Iowa that it made the difference here. But yeah, it's amazing. It's just astonishing, just at the level of voting rights. Let's say we're just all about voting. That's what we care about. We care about the ability to participate in the two-party electoral process. Just at that level, it's amazing the disappearance of that issue. That issue actually was raised in ways that got some attention by good investigative journalists like Greg Palast, you know, in 2000 and 2004. But I mean, just, you know, that's something I wish I'd written about, because as you just said that, it just sparked me. That's a really important observation. And that disappeared from the discussion of what happened in 2016. I mean, I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yes, for example, John Lewis, who is known as Mr. Vote when they're not calling him the Lord, the black congressman from Atlanta, Georgia, when the election returns came in, instead of focusing on the clear and obvious voter suppression patterns, he started talking about the Russians.
Yeah, talking about the Russians. Yeah, doesn't Maxine Waters do that too? It's just astonishing. Of course, everything's elections with John Lewis. And what an irony, given his early beginnings as someone who entered the stage of American history by engaging in the politics of the streets and the politics of direct action and the politics of social movements beneath and beyond the quadrennial extravaganzas. It's just a sort of tragic to see this kind of outcome at the end of his career. You know, I wish liberals and progressives who've gotten caught up in the Russia thing would go back and look at a remarkable essay that came out in New York Review of Books in March of this year. It was by Masha Gessen. And the title of the essay was Russia, the Conspiracy Trap. And Masha Gessen, tried to warn against people putting all their anti-Trump eggs in the Russia basket, A, because she thought it would flop, ultimately for the reasons of lack of smoking gun evidence and lack of sufficient public interest, particularly in Trump's own base. But, I mean, her bigger concern was that the Russia obsession would divert people from issues that ought to matter to liberals and progressives, like racism, like voter suppression, like health care access, you know, like plutocracy, the police state, police shootings, immigrant rights, all of that stuff, the stuff that supposedly liberals and progressives care about. And Masha Gessen, okay, said, watch out. You're going to get everything to get sucked into Russia, 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 and you're going to lose touch with the issues that ought to matter to Democrats. Now, you know, whether they really do or not, you know, is sort of a question that leftists, you know, long-term American leftists like ourselves probably would have a question mark about, and she's from Russia. But what made that warning particularly interesting, that it's coming from Masha Gessen, is that she is a gay Russian anti-Putin dissident, right? Someone you might expect to be predisposed to point the finger at Moscow, right? She has a history of opposing the Russian oligarchy. But here she is saying, be careful. This is a diversion, and you're going to wish you hadn't gone there in the first place.
That was historian and author Paul Street. Democracy advocates from the Central American nation of Honduras journeyed to the United States last month, asking the Trump administration not to recognize the disputed results of the recent election in Honduras. The incumbent president was declared the winner despite widespread evidence of fraud. even the Organization of American States, which usually takes its cues from Washington, called for the elections to be done all over again because the count could not be trusted. However, the U.S. State Department said it saw nothing wrong with the vote. Back in 2009, Washington backed a military coup in Honduras. We spoke with Chiara Taylor, a U.S. activist in solidarity with Honduras.
This situation goes back to hundreds of years of U.S. imperialism and colonization, but I think most immediate to the coup in 2009 was Zelaya. And so you have a lot of people here who have a very real memory of the ways in which U.S. has intervened in their country and their politics spanning quite a long time. And so a lot of the folks that you see on the ground, of course, are young, are Black, are Indigenous. And, you know, these youth who are really rising up, people are saying this is a bigger or larger demonstration than we're even seeing in 2009. I think a lot of that is due to the fact that the youth who are in the streets now were the youth who were coming up in 2009 when Zelaya was taken out by the U.S. government.
And in fact, being in the streets in Honduras is taking your life in your hands. Many activists have been killed since the U.S.-backed coup back in 2009.
Yes, and still today, the strategy of the military in the Honduras has been to kill young activists in front of other young activists to discourage them from resisting. And, you know, as a person, as an organizer, as an activist in the United States, who is just beginning to see the ways that the U.S. government is repressive and also understanding history and the fact that, you know, the United States not only has a military, a large military base in the Honduras, of which they have led, you know, many terrorist activities in other Latin American countries. You see that, like, the practices that they tried out, the torture practices, practices of repression, and the way in which the military has moved in the Honduras are practices that they bring back to the United States. And so just the implications of this and these tactics that are being used by the military are just very alarming. I mean, a lot of young people have been killed. Over 30 people have been killed. 10 people were killed in just one night. There was a 17-year-old young woman who was killed at the airport. This most recent round of targeting young activists really started with a 14-year-old girl who is not like a lead organizer. She was just out in the street standing up for her community and for her country and its sovereignty and the ability for people and the right for people to be able to have a say in their government and political matters.
And of course, in Honduras, as in the rest of the Americas, political repression is a factor of race as well as class.
Yes, exactly. And you'll see, like I said, a lot of the people in the streets are young, they're Indigenous, they're Black, a lot led by the Garifuna people, who were African captives who rebelled on the slave ships in the Caribbean, fought off the English, Dutch, and French, and then were swept up and then, you know, strung along the coast of Latin America and Guatemala and Belize and, of course, in the Honduras. And so you're really seeing the legacy of African descendants continuing to fight for liberation and their ability to chart our own path forward.
Now, this call by the Organization of African States for a new election is quite significant politically because the OAS has historically been a mouthpiece for U.S. foreign policy.
I think that what we're seeing is the United States is losing a lot of the credibility that they held in the world. And you're seeing people really responding and building power in ways outside of the West and really beginning to resist U.S. imperialism, colonialism, and occupation. And so I think that this is the right path forward. Unity between African nations and South American nations. And I think it's just a really beautiful thing that I hope to see continued.
That was Chiara Taylor, an activist in solidarity with democracy in Honduras. Uganda, the heavily armed U.S. ally in Africa, has openly deployed its armed forces in the Beni region of the Republic of Congo.
the same area that Uganda and Rwanda, another U.S. client state, have repeatedly invaded over the past two decades, resulting in the death of at least 6 million people. This time, Uganda is claiming to be fighting a small Islamic guerrilla group that is blamed for killing 15 United Nations peacekeepers. But many observers doubt the official story. Helen Epstein is a visiting professor of public health and human rights at Bard College. She's the author of the book Another Fine Mess: America, Uganda, and the War on Terror. She was interviewed by Greg Wilpert on the Real News Network. Epstein says it's not at all clear who the killers in Congo actually work for.
What typically happens, according to accounts by local witnesses, is that very often people who look like soldiers will actually turn up in a village wearing Congolese army uniforms, gain people's confidence by saying, "We're here to protect you. We hear there's some militants in the region," and so on. And then once everyone's kind of relaxed and sort of their guard is down, suddenly these very same individuals in army uniforms will begin massacring people. And witnesses say that some of those people do seem to be members of the Allied Democratic Forces, but that in many cases, members of the Congolese military are also involved and sometimes seem to be carrying out the most brutal attacks. So in some cases, it seems as though they're just doing this for no reason, as though they're just trying to kind of demonstrate how brutal they can be. So they'll slaughter the men first to get them out of the way so they can protect anyone else, force everyone else to watch that, and then one by one, work their way through the women, children, and the elderly, and even health workers. It's a ghastly situation. And as I said, this has been going on for 3 years, and we know almost nothing about it. I mean, we hear almost nothing about it. Local people, of course, know a great deal about what's going on. But there's been a kind of strange silence about it, despite the fact that it has indeed caused the hundreds of thousands of people in this area to flee their homes. Where they then need to be taken care of by charities in the international community when they were once, until very recently, supporting themselves as farmers. It's a dreadful situation.
To what extent can one say that natural resource acquisition and exploitation is at the heart of this? I mean, it is well known that that part of Africa is a area that is very rich in natural resources of all kinds. To what extent would you say is that fueling what's going on there right now?
Many people are scratching their heads and wondering if that's not the case as to what's going on. It's worth noting a couple things. One of them is that some of the people involved in these attacks, especially the ones in Congolese army uniforms, it turns out that both Rwanda and Uganda have since the early beginning in the mid 1990s, they invaded Congo, this particular region of Congo, and really occupied the area for many years. Their main armies left in 2003 after a peace deal was signed, but they've continued to support proxy forces in the region that have been involved in trafficking in resources and also in horrific human rights abuses against the population. And as part of the various settlements over time, peace deals have also been enacted with these groups. And as a condition of those peace deals, some of them have been integrated into the Congolese army. And it's thought that those people, actually, these sort of former rebel combatants, seem to be involved in the current attacks. And what they're doing is not clear. There is a great deal of oil underneath the surface of Beni. And Uganda is, these are oil fields that are actually linked to Uganda and Uganda's oil fields, which Uganda is currently exploiting. And so that's worth bearing in mind. but it's also the case that large numbers of peasants seem to be arriving, many of them from Rwanda, saying that they are Congolese refugees who are now returning from Rwanda to settle back in their lands. But these people, many of them don't actually speak Swahili very well, which is the lingua franca of Congo. And so some people are kind of wondering, they speak very good Kinyarwanda, so people are wondering if they're really Congolese, or are they perhaps Rwandans that are being settled there as a sort of de facto way of occupying this incredibly lucrative area, which also happens to be kind of at the crossroads of the illegal trade in gold and timber and ivory and especially coltan, which is the raw material of cell phones and computer chips. So whoever has possession of this particular area really controls the trade in that and all of those materials, and therefore can do extremely well. But exactly what's going on, unfortunately, we really don't know.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.